It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about estate planning now and ensuring assets go where you intend them after death, and how to successfully create a valid will under Wisconsin laws to avoid the probate process. Call in with a question. You can share your perspective at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Chantel Ringy is a partner at Hill Glowacki. That's a Madison law firm with practice areas in estate planning, elder law, and special needs planning. Chantel, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much, Kate.
So when a family member passes away without a will or an estate plan, and the distribution of their assets usually determined by the probate court process, why do attorneys recommend strategies for avoiding probate?
Well, I don't know that I've ever met a client who was very excited to have to petition the court. That said, our Dane County commissioners are very friendly and relatively easy to deal with in my experience. But I think there's something about the court process that adds this sort of extra layer of stress for many folks. And if they can avoid that, or if my clients can know that their loved ones can avoid that upon their passing, then generally with a bit of planning, we're able to accomplish that.
Is probate a concern only for large estates, or is it a concern at all levels?
Probate is, in Wisconsin, a court proceeding that's required when there are assets that total in value $50,000 or more that don't otherwise pass by, let's say, joint ownership. For example, if you have a joint account and it's held with survivorship with the other owner, then that will pass automatically without the need for any kind of administration. Or assets that pass automatically because you've named a beneficiary to receive it and that beneficiary survives you. But otherwise, if you have at least $50,000 of assets that don't otherwise pass that way, then Wisconsin law does require the probate proceeding.
What factors might complicate a probate case and might be frustrating for surviving family members?
Well, it does involve, by statute, the publication of notice to creditors in the paper. So there's a legal notice that's published in the state journal if the person passed away in Dane County. And heirs at law need to be notified of the proceedings. And those persons may not be beneficiaries under the will or under the they would be under the rules of intestacy, but if you have a will, it doesn't mean that you've named your heirs, but yet in a probate proceeding, those persons must be notified. So for instance, if you've named your unmarried partner or charities and excluded your heirs, nevertheless, if a probate is required, those persons need to receive a copy of the will, and they do have an opportunity to object to the proceedings. That's not always something that my clients like the idea of.
So it becomes a much more public process, as you said before.
It does. And there is an entry on the Wisconsin CCAP website. One could discern, I suppose, the size of the estate, even from the inventory fee that's paid, and that is public.
We're talking about estate planning and alternatives to probate court with a Madison attorney. Chantel Ringy is here fielding your questions and comments at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Chantel, a deceased family member could have a written legal will and their family could still have to go through probate to settle the estate. What might be the cause of those situations?
That's exactly right. So having a will is something that hopefully we all consider and do. It's sort of a very basic fundamental step in planning for how your assets are distributed upon your death and who is going to handle that. But having a will alone does not allow you to avoid probate necessarily. Again, the trigger would be if you have assets that don't pass automatically that total $50,000. So those are the situations in which maybe you would like to consider establishing something beyond just a basic will. If you're motivated to allow your beneficiaries to avoid the probate process, then you might consider something along the lines of a revocable trust, which is also a very common estate planning tool. And really, its sole purpose is to avoid probate of your assets upon your death. It's kind of this legal fiction, the revocable trust. It is essentially, if you direct assets to your revocable trust, perhaps during your lifetime by titling assets in the name of the trust, and also oftentimes upon your death by designating the trust as the beneficiary on beneficiary designation forms, then those assets that are in your revocable trust upon your passing are not in your probate estate. And so, according to this, as I say, legal fiction, those assets get to avoid probate. So, that's kind of in a nutshell the structure of the revocable trust type of planning, which, as I say, is fairly simple to establish, and it's a pretty common estate planning tool. Many of my clients, once they learn of that option, are interested in pursuing it, and it's designed to avoid probate.
Then,
So having a will alone is not sufficient, unfortunately, to avoid the probate process.
and then how is a revocable trust or a living trust different from what is happening in the will?
So generally, the revocable trust will contain many of the similar provisions that you might have still in your will. They'll have the substantive provisions regarding who's to receive what upon your passing. But essentially, it is just designed to avoid probate. And I think the impetus behind the allowance to avoid probate in our statutes is just this notion that if you've done enough planning on the front end to avoid the process of probate, then our legislature feels that, okay, we can take a more hands-off approach. In the event of your death, we will allow the individual you've designated to serve as your successor trustee to administer those assets outside of the jurisdiction, the oversight of the probate court.
Let's bring on a call now. Laura in Grand Marsh. Laura, go ahead.
Yes, I'm trying to get these things settled with regards to will and trust, but what my concern right now is I wanted to know, my husband is concerned that if I pass away, how would he handle his finances? So I wanted to set up a durable power of attorney for finances. Can I do that on my own, or do I need an attorney to do that?
Laura, thank you. And if you could step back also for a moment, Chantel, and explain what a durable power of attorney is, what this person does.
That is an excellent question, Laura. A durable power of attorney is generally regarded as something that would allow an agent to manage your financial affairs, but it only applies while you're living. That's true with regard to the healthcare power of attorney as well. So, Laura, your husband's concern with respect to what he would do if you were to pass away would not really be alleviated by your establishing a financial durable power of attorney, because again, that type of form expires, so to speak, upon your death. So having something like a will or a trust would be something you'd want to pursue. At the same time, I don't want to slight the planning that is involved in establishing powers of attorney, because those are excellent documents to have in place if you are living and you suffer an incapacity, such as dementia or a stroke or some sort of acute emergency situation. It's in that context in which the agent who's designated under your durable power of attorney for finances would have authority to do things like access your bank accounts to pay your bills, file income tax returns on your behalf, contract on your behalf, and maybe apply for Medicaid. In terms of the question, Laura, that you have, do you need to work with an attorney to establish a durable power of attorney for finances? The answer is no, you do not have to. There is a statutory form in Wisconsin for a durable power of attorney for finances. The downside of not working with an attorney and just using the state form is that if you ever do have a real long-term disabling condition, that statutory form unfortunately lacks many of the planning authorities that we rely on at Hill Glowacki, for instance, to help the agent do things like maybe qualify you for long-term care Medicaid benefits. And those additional authorities can be extremely helpful. Another type might be to include the authority to create a special needs trust on your behalf. You're not going to find those authorities in the statutory form. So while having that statutory form is better than having nothing, and it is free, you just really need a notary to notarize your signature, it's of limited value depending on your circumstances.
Chantel Ringey is a Madison-based attorney focused on estate planning and elder law, special needs planning. You can join the conversation at any point, calling in with a question, sharing your comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine the set of legal documents that outline how a person's assets will be distributed upon death. And you can be part of this conversation about estate planning and how to protect and pass down assets to family members. Call in with a question, add comments along the way, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. We have Chantel Ringey, who is a partner at Hill Glowacki in Madison. Chantel, parents can designate guardians of their minor children in the event of their death, and people who have lost a spouse can give power of attorney to an adult child to make health care or financial decisions for the surviving parent. At what stage of life do you recommend people start the estate planning process?
Well, I think you touched on what I've always regarded as the most important time of life to establish your estate plan, or at least some form of estate planning, and that is if you have children. So in Wisconsin, the only place you can designate a successor guardian for a minor child is in your will. The same is true if you're the guardian of a special needs adult child. You can designate or nominate, I should say. It still needs to be approved by the court, but you can make that nomination within your will. And what's more important planning than trying to ensure that your child has as streamlined of a handoff as possible in the event of your unfortunate passing? So that is extremely important. The other time of another instance might be I kind of hit on it. If you have an individual who is going to be a beneficiary of your estate and they have special needs, that's another occasion in which it can be very helpful to do some planning in advance so that when they receive whatever it might be from your estate, it doesn't, for instance, jeopardize their eligibility for perhaps public benefits that they're reliant upon. And to also make sure that there's someone who is able to administer those assets for their benefit. We do prepare in those instances special needs trusts for such beneficiaries. So that's another occasion when it can be extremely helpful and important to do a bit of planning on the front end.
As you bring up these scenarios, it makes me wonder, like, Is it permissible to shop around or inquire how much it will cost to set up these specific things or an estate plan? Or how do you find the expertise you need for your situation?
That's a good question. So, yes, I think it should be encouraged that consumers shop around, get an idea for is this really in the wheelhouse for the attorney who you're considering doing the planning with? What is a ballpark of their fees? And what are you getting for those fees? A good resource is the Wisconsin chapter of the National Association of Elder Law Attorneys. The vast majority of those members are very invested in estate planning as part of their practice area. And they do have a directory online that you can find with just a Google search. But there are very well qualified, many well qualified attorneys in our area who do estate planning. But certainly call around, get an idea of the cost, don't walk into it blindly, and take some recommendations from family members or friends as well who maybe have gone through the process recently themselves.
Let's bring in Phyllis in Wausau with a question. Hi, Phyllis.
Hello.
What would you like to
My
ask?
question. Okay. My question is, I have a friend who died recently with no close kin, no will, no nothing. How is that property handled? What is the process?
Those can be very difficult cases, not necessarily because of the assets that need to be administered. But for instance, I have a very similar situation in one of my client matters at the law firm now, and woman passed away and she had no relatives in the area. And the rel she did have a will, but no one really knew any of the named beneficiaries. And so sometimes that means we're hiring an air search firm to locate people, or sometimes we at the law firm are doing quite a bit of online searching and making phone calls blindly to try to find who are the interested persons. If the person has no will, then essentially the state of Wisconsin has established an estate plan for them in our statutes, the rules of intestacy. So generally, if a person passes away with no surviving spouse and no surviving descendants, then you're looking at, do they have surviving parents? Perhaps not. If not, then you're looking at who are their surviving siblings and the descendants of any predeceased siblings. So you can imagine situations in which we're going pretty far down the chain and really trying to locate people who have no idea who the decedent is or maybe never met him or her. So those are the cases where I really do encourage folks who have maybe charitable intentions or a very friendly neighbor who's always helped out, right? Establish an estate plan and designate who you really do want your assets to pass to, whatever it may be, large or small, because even if it's, $50,000 in your bank account, it could mean a fair amount of work for whoever is left to handle the affairs. And in the case that I have in my office right now, it's the legal guardian of the woman when she passed away who's handling the administration of the estate, just because she's a third party, just a retired attorney, but she was most familiar with the woman's affairs, and so she's the one who's kind of taking the rowing oar. They can be difficult situations.
We're discussing estate planning, all aspects of it, with Madison attorney Chantel Ringy and taking your calls. Let's go to Alicia in Little Chute. Alicia, hi. What would you like to bring up?
I have a complex situation. I have two children, a son and a daughter. And the son has been diagnosed as bipolar, seasonal affective schizophrenic, possibly. He's terrible at handling money. The other one can handle the money, and I'm not sure. I can do well, and it's kind of, I'm kind of a 50-50 person for my children, adult children, and I'm not sure how to handle his portion because if he would get it, it would be gone in a heartbeat.
Alicia, I want to toss this over to Chantel to get your thoughts in a situation like this, Chantel.
Alicia, you're not alone in your situation and your concerns. We have many clients who have a loved one who they would ideally like to benefit in their estate plan, but their loved one has some special needs or some inability to manage funds. When that's the case, we generally recommend a special needs trust. What that would allow is for you to appoint the person or organization to manage your son's, in this instance, share of your estate after your passing. So that, as you say, he's not spending it without regard for his long-term well-being. So you have a trustee who's in charge of administering the assets for the benefit of the special needs person. The other thing that that trustee should be aware of
very quickly
is what will distributions do in the way of affecting his eligibility for things like Medicaid.
And I'm going to just jump in here. Chantel Ringy, attorney, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. When a person dies, we learn about the process to transfer their property and other assets with estate planning tools that can help avoid probate. A Wisconsin attorney fields your questions about estate planning and call in to be part of the discussion. Add your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Chantel Ringy works on cases involving estate planning, elder law, and special needs planning. Chantel, once you do set up your documents and have those intentions, in those legal areas, those legal documents, how do you suggest communicating that information to loved ones or, multiple kids?
So what I typically recommend is that certainly you first make sure that whoever the persons are who you're naming as agent, to serve in various capacities in the event of your incapacity or your passing, that you talk with them first, make sure that they feel comfortable serving in that position, and ultimately that they know that they've been named. I also always recommend that clients provide a copy of their healthcare directives to their nominated healthcare agents in case they're ever called upon in the event of an emergency to make, quick healthcare decisions for you. Beyond that, our names are generally, the firm name is generally included on the documents themselves, so that if your, let's say, adult child locates your documents, and they should be told where they are. If they're in a safe deposit box at your bank, hopefully the child is named as an authorized person to access that box and they know where the keys are. Or if they're in a lockbox in your basement, hopefully they know where the key to that is or the code to get in. So let your agents know where the documents are so that they can be found if necessary, and make sure that they have a copy of your healthcare directive. So your doctor's office should also get a copy of your healthcare directive so that they know, or the emergency room knows if you end up there, who your agents are who should be contacted.
Christine emailed in to ask about a life estate. Christine established a life estate for their house and heard that the state of Wisconsin will claim part of this money if they need nursing home care in the future. And Christine's wondering how much of the value of their home would the state receive?
That is a question that I cannot answer without more information. And it really won't be discernible until their passing. And if she's married, if Christine is married, then it won't be until the passing of her and her spouse. It is correct. So a life estate, backing up, is this notion that you are transferring a future interest in your home, but you're preserving for yourself the right to live there as long as you're alive and prefer to live there. Or can live there. And so the owner has this retained interest, and it used to be that if you received long-term care Medicaid benefits during your lifetime and you had this life estate, when you passed away, the life estate interest went away, and Medicaid's estate recovery rights could not apply to that life estate interest. But I believe it was 2014 when our statutes changed in that regard. Medicaid's estate recovery rights were broadened. And one of the things that became subject to their right of recovery are life estates. And so that's correct. If you have a life estate that was established after, I believe it's August 1st of 2014, then it, and if you've received long-term care Medicaid benefits or your spouse has, then there is likely to be some claim against that interest in the event of your death. The idea being, of course, this is a publicly funded program, and the federal government, in fact, I think mandates that our state government attempt to recover what it can from assets that remain from in the beneficiary's estate when they pass.
How do survivors deal with outstanding debts left by a deceased family member, especially in the situation of too little money remains in the estate to pay down the debt?
That's a good question. So our statutes do dictate sort of an order of priority when it comes to various creditors. And as you might imagine, the government is generally at the top of that list. Mm-hmm. So things like Medicaid or tax debt, you know, those types of debts certainly do take priority over a beneficiary's right to inherit, with some exceptions, I should say. But generally speaking, that's the case. Unsecured creditors, when there isn't enough money to go around, oftentimes they don't receive anything. And so that's part of the impetus behind the requirement to file the notice to creditors in the newspaper so that creditors at large, even if you don't know about who the creditors of your loved one might be, they have an opportunity and in many cases an obligation to file a claim so that they can be identified. And if there's an opportunity with money remaining to negotiate a reduced payback, perhaps their claim could be resolved. But otherwise, there are instances when if there's no money there, there's nothing to pay the creditors. And so, unfortunately, they are not always paid.
We're talking about estate planning and the probate process with Madison attorney Chantel Ringy. You can join in with questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Valerie is with us in Madison. Valerie, hi. Go ahead.
Hi. I recently responded to a mailing solicitation to attend an estate planning workshop at which a free meal at a nice restaurant would be offered. And I researched a little bit behind the firm and found out that the attorney was licensed in Illinois, not Wisconsin. So I contacted the firm, and the attorney responded saying that they wrote up documents using a Zoom call with a licensed Wisconsin attorney. So I was just wondering about the, about that whole situation.
Thanks, Valerie. Chantel, what are the implications of borderlines in a situation like that?
Well, the best advice is to have an estate planning meeting and have your estate plan drafted by and with an attorney who is licensed in the state where you reside. So maybe in that situation, there are a lot of cooks in the kitchen, it sounds like, and perhaps some of it has to do with who's better at marketing than the other. But you know, most people, I think, want to sit down with their estate planning attorney. It's during those discussions that so many important points arise. And if that attorney with whom you're having that meaningful discussion with is not licensed in the state of your residence, then they may be missing planning opportunities or other things that would jump out to someone who is. Someone who's licensed in Illinois could not prepare, for instance, a marital property agreement for someone in Wisconsin. And we often do prepare, in the context of an estate plan, a marital property agreement that can have a lot of value to the overall estate. I mean, Illinois is not a marital property state like Wisconsin is. And so there are certainly nuances in the laws between states, and it is very important that you meet with and do your planning with an attorney who's licensed where you live.
along those lines, you know, how portable is your estate plan, for instance, if you do move to another state?
Good question. So just because you've relocated to a new state does not mean that you need to toss out your old documents and have an entirely new estate plan, but that is definitely an occasion when you should plan to sit down with an attorney, blow the dust off of your old state estate plan, and determine whether there are some updates that should be made. And if it's because of Wisconsin's very unique marital property laws, there are occasions when updates are warranted, or when someone's moving to Wisconsin from another state, you know, vice versa, when updates could be made that could be helpful. So that is one of the times of life, or one of the events of life, I should say, when meeting with an estate planning attorney to discuss any recommended updates is helpful.
Sandy has emailed in to ask, what are the initial steps to follow when a spouse dies, assuming that a will or an estate plan is established?
So one of the initial steps would be to review the estate plan. And oftentimes when it's a spousal situation, so there's a surviving spouse, there often is no need for an actual probate proceeding, because many times most or all assets are set up in a way that they're either held jointly with the surviving spouse, or the surviving spouse was named as the beneficiary. And it sounds like this is an occasion when there was some planning done. So hopefully that's the case. Maybe you have a trust established already. It would probably warrant picking up the phone and giving a call to the attorney who drafted, or the law firm that drafted the estate plan, to just let them know that your spouse has passed, and get some pointers in terms of maybe who to call in the way of making claims on assets, or things that could be cleaned up. Mm-hmm. But when you've done planning, hopefully it's a short list and just a matter of, as they say, making phone calls, and not necessarily the case that you're going to have to petition the probate court.
There are online tools, as you know, for writing wills and other estate planning documents. Are there risks of filling out forms through these types of online services without the help of an attorney?
I think it's great that there are online tools available. I think it's the goal is to help meet a need that certainly exists. And some people don't have funds to sit down with an attorney, or for whatever reason, don't choose to do that. When that's not the case, when you do have some wealth, or when you do have what you know to be a complicated situation, like our caller earlier with the beneficiary with disabilities, those are situations in which it really does help to, it really does add value to have that conversation with a lawyer, because unfortunately, many of the online tools are set up in a way that they're sort of one size fits all, and you're not going to get the planning that might really be helpful for your loved one. And sometimes even when you think what you need is just a simple will, what you might be getting is not exactly what you intend. I mean, there is a reason why law school is 3 years and grueling. We do learn a lot in that process.
Chantel Ringy is an attorney in Madison, works on estate planning, elder law, and special needs planning. You can join the conversation at any point. Call in with a question. You can share your perspective, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine the transfer of assets after death and different facets of estate planning here in Wisconsin. And you can call in with a question, share your thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas at wpr.org. Chantel Ringy is a partner at the Madison Law Firm, Hill Glowacki. Let's go to Leisha now in Spring Green. Leisha, hi, go ahead.
Hi, my brother passed away unexpectedly in early 2021, and he didn't leave a will. And so I had to go through Dane County probate. I'm in Sauk County, and I probably went there at least four times. And depending on who I talked to, some of the people I talked to there were wonderful, and others were not helpful at all, and I had a terrible time. I got through about two-thirds of it, and I finally got to a point where I consulted with an attorney. I hired an attorney, and they told me that I didn't have to do a final accounting, and I showed up at Dane County Probate, and they said, oh, yes, you absolutely do. So I had to go back home and do all that, and he had quite a bit in his estate and was quite a process. And so I paid that attorney $600 for bad information, and it really bothered me a lot.
Leisha, thank you for sharing such a personal story. And Chantel, what do you make of a story like that and having to go through a process that is so unexpected and certainly not something that people understand?
Yes, it can be frustrating. It can be a long, drawn-out process, and certainly it's filled with various documents that the probate court requires you to submit. And I don't know that I've ever had two probates that are the same. There are occasions when you can avoid the accounting requirement, but you need all of the beneficiaries to waive that properly in writing. But, you know, there's the inventory that you need to file. There's generally a final accounting, and then they want to make sure that you've done all necessary income tax filings. So there's a certificate that they want to see from the state of Wisconsin that attests to that. You know, there is an inventory fee that you need to pay the probate court. It's relatively small, but it is based on the size of the estate. So as Leisha said, when you have a larger estate, as in her case, you're going to have a larger inventory fee, and all of those things sort of compound to make a stressful situation in which you might be trying to grieve the loss of your loved one even more difficult. Not that they're trying to make it difficult for you, but you will hear from the folks at the Dane County Probate Court repeatedly that they are not lawyers and they're not authorized to give legal advice. And so I'm sorry to hear that you did not receive good legal advice or legal advice that was relevant for your situation, Leisha. But it generally can be very helpful to make a phone call to an attorney to just find out what it is that you need to complete and maybe get some help completing those documents if you need assistance. I'm sorry to hear about that experience. Yes, if he had done a bit of planning, then you probably could have avoided that.
Let's bring in Richard now in Milwaukee. Richard, hi. Richard, are you there?
I'm sorry to hear about that experience.
Okay, Richard, I don't think is there anymore. Is wondering who decides jurisdiction for legal documents, especially if you've moved?
So in terms of which state has jurisdiction, the probate, if you need a probate, that will be in the county where you passed away. Mm-hmm. So we frequently receive phone calls from loved ones who reside outside of Wisconsin, but their family member or friend passed away in the state, and they're having to open a probate in Wisconsin. Sometimes if you have real estate in multiple states, that might mean you have multiple probates too, which, you know, that definitely makes it even more valuable to have planning done in advance to avoid that process. So it's the county where the decedent resided when they passed away that has jurisdiction of any probate. If they have documents drafted in another state, then generally the substantive provisions of those laws, that state's laws, apply, but the procedural laws of the state where you died apply in order to determine what procedures are required. So it can be kind of a mashup of the laws that apply in those situations.
let's bring a question about wills now. Jeremy in Bayfield. Jeremy, hi.
Hi. Hi. I got a question that's related to copies of wills. My sister and brother and I are named as beneficiaries in a will, but there is no, we can't find the original will, and so the attorney that drew up the will has a copy. And I'm just wondering if we need to get a lawyer besides him to make sure that that the copy of the will is validated, because there's a person that who's not named a sister of the deceased who may contest the whole thing.
Jeremy, thank you. Chantel, what about the validity of the will and copies?
So in Wisconsin, the probate courts will generally want to see the original of the will, and that's what they prefer to admit to probate. If that cannot be located, and certainly there are situations in which that's the case, maybe there was a fire or the individual moved numerous times or it just simply was displaced, then there are occasions when the probate court will accept a copy for admission to probate, but you have to convince them that it's valid and that the original wasn't revoked, because one manner of revoking a will is by destroying it. So who's to say that it wasn't destroyed, right? So usually, for instance, in Dane County, when we have situations where the original will cannot be located, certainly you want to make your best effort to find it, first of all, checking all of the sort of usual places. It sounds like you called the attorney who drafted the will. That's great. But when it can't be found in Dane County, if we submit an affidavit, you know, a sworn statement that the copy is believed to be the will that was still in effect at the time of death, and that you've attempted to locate the original, unless there's a contest, then generally our probate court will accept that. But it sounds like maybe there's someone who perhaps would object, and it's in those cases where it becomes potentially more of a protracted argument about whether it is in fact the will that was in force at the time of death.
We only have a few seconds left. On wills, does Wisconsin recognize handwritten wills?
Wisconsin does. What our law wants to see, though, is that you have two disinterested witnesses who have watched the testator, testatrix, the person signing the will, sign and have also signed it themselves.
Chantel, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. I've enjoyed the conversation.
Chantel Ringy is a partner at the Madison law firm Hill Glowacki, with practice areas that involve estate planning, that involve elder law and special needs planning. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We tour through a digital museum called Wisconsin 101. It's a statewide public history project using objects from around the state, think like a soda bottle, a serving dish, a vinyl record, to help tell about the place we call home. Call in with the question, share what's on your mind, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Tom Broman is co-director of Wisconsin 101 and emeritus professor of history of science at UW-Madison. Tom, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. It's really great to join you today. It's great to be inside and join you today.
Yes, I like that distinction, indeed. You say people often don't think of objects as a vehicle for history. Why not?
I think it depends on sort of where you're doing the history. So For example, when I was in school, we learned history by reading it in books, basically. And the books, at the time, U.S. history was taught with presidents and wars and things like that. It's become much more diverse now, but it's still very text-based. And I think you learn a lot by reading books about history. You're reading stories that are sort of organized for us, but you're not directly experiencing it. Now, museums have been around for a very long time, and museums give you a much better opportunity to directly experience history by seeing objects that are kind of relics from the past. And so we do have chances to experience history through objects, but we often read about it in ways that really is just about sort of telling stories that have nothing to do with the material remnants of the past.
So, I mean, I wonder, does this lens into the past, you know, bringing forth different objects that people have in their lives or in their communities, does that make history feel more alive?
I think it does. And an example is the tendency all of us have to retain heirlooms from our grandparents or even further ancestors further back, where often we carry things around which contain parts of family history that are meaningful to us. And so we do that in terms of the past of our own families, but we can also do it in terms of the ways we look at objects in museums and use those objects as focal points for imagining what lives were like in the past. Objects in museums do that all the time. And they're very good for that because they're kind of the presence of the past, right? Mm-hmm. If you go to the British Museum in London and you look at some ancient Roman coins from Britain when it was occupied by the Romans 2,000 years ago, you're seeing a remnant of that period right before your eyes.
But I think what you're doing here to me, it seems more of like crowdsourcing history. Like you're allowing everyone the ability to be a curator, that you don't have to go to a museum where something is curated. What do you make of that?
Well, that was the intention. One of the intentions of developing the project as we did, when my partner Sarah Thal and I decided to start this project back around 2011, the one aim was to give students a chance to do something more with their history writing than to write a 10-page paper at the end of the semester that they throw out or keep forever, if in the case of some people. We wanted them to feel like it had some public value to what they were doing. So we've used a lot of undergraduates have contributed to this project, but we wanted to give everyone a chance to tell stories that were meaningful in their locality, right? One of the problems that we have is that we since we're situated in Madison, in the history department at UW-Madison, we didn't want to determine what the state's local history should be from there. We wanted to try and encourage more stories coming in from everywhere. And to an extent, that's been partially successful. It's always recruiting people to write for us is always a challenge. But we've had good participation from different parts of the state.
How is the state of Maine, the Maine Memory Network, kind of a role model?
Oh, that was when I was casting around for what a statewide project might look like when we were first starting about this. I found very few statewide historical organizations that had actually attempted to do something similar, that is both local history, but mounted on a statewide basis. About over 20 years ago, the Maine Historical Society, which is actually the Portland Maine Historical Society, because on the East Coast model that the state, what calls itself the State Historical Society, is actually the local society of the town that was settled during colonial times. So the Maine Historical Society is in Portland, Maine, the Massachusetts Historical Society is in Boston, but it's really about Boston and so on. Anyway, the Maine Historical Society decided they wanted to have a more statewide reach. And one thing, they came up with this great idea of trying to engage local communities in writing their own history. And they did it by securing grants from the National Endowment of the Humanities to hire staff people who would go around to different towns and enlist the local high school, the local historical society, and the public library in a collaborative effort to write town history. I found that fascinating and a wonderful idea to get the town talking about its own history, guided by people who sort of had some experience in getting these local histories written. Mm-hmm. And the project has been this website called the Maine Memory Network. And over 20 years, it's become kind of big and cluttered. Websites don't age well. And I don't mean that as a criticism, but taking the original stories, getting the original stories from the Maine Memory Network takes a bit of work, but they're really cool. They're nicely done. They're interesting. They tell a lot of local flavor. I wish we could do something like that, but Wisconsin's a much bigger and different state. It would take a lot more resources to do, but it's a wonderful inspiration of how you can do a statewide local history.
Tom Broman with us, director of a public history project called Wisconsin 101, as we talk about the history of our state through material objects. And you can join in with questions and comments. Maybe you have one, 800-642-1234. Eugene in Viola is here. Eugene, hi.
Good morning, Kate. I got a frog out of my throat. I've got a shoeshine stand. I bought it in 1954 from the local barbershop, so I've had it for almost 70 years. And I started doing Civil War reenactments, and I'm going back on the road again this summer, and I got about four or five events to do in southern Wisconsin. And it isn't me and it isn't the stand. It's the people that go through and the stories that you've got to tell.
Oh, you
run into all kinds of them. I started out shining shoes for 15 cents. Now I charge $4 for a shoe shine.
A bit of inflation there, Eugene. A shoe shine stand from 1954 in a barbershop, Tom.
I would love to have an object like that. Would be a great thing to write about as a way of describing the role of barbershops in town life from mid-20th century. That is, sometimes very common objects can give us great local stories if you have ways of situating them in a place, right, in a town, wherever the shoe sign stand was. It doesn't have to be a unique object, in other words. Some of our best objects are kind of common objects, which nevertheless talk about interesting stories in the towns where they lived their working mm-hmm. lives.
Professor Emeritus of the History of Science at UW-Madison, Tom Broman with us, co-director of the public history platform called Wisconsin 101. As we discuss objects that draw out Wisconsin's rich history, you can share in the conversation. Call in with a question, add comments at any point, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about a public history project. It is called Wisconsin 101, celebrating, preserving, sharing local history across the state through objects. And we have its co-director of Wisconsin 101, Tom Broman, is an Emeritus History of Science professor at UW-Madison. Be part of the conversation along the way. Call in with a question. You can share your perspective at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So I want to ask about an object that is left out. Why is the Lincoln bed from the Tallman House in Janesville omitted from the platform?
Well, I often use the Lincoln. That's a good question. I often use the Lincoln bed as an example of why some objects don't work on Wisconsin 101. So let me give you a little bit of the background story. In fall of 1859, Abraham Lincoln was running for president, or beginning to run for president, trying to build up his national reputation. And he had given a speech at the state fair in Milwaukee, and he was on his way. His next stop was, he went to Beloit to give a talk. And in Beloit, he met the owner of the house, the owner of the Tallman house, William Tallman from Janesville. William Tallman was a lawyer. He had built this nice house in Janesville. He was known as an abolitionist in the community, so he was definitely a supporter of Lincoln as a national figure. And Tallman went down to Beloit and convinced Lincoln to come and spend the night in Janesville and give a talk in Janesville. And Lincoln, because in those days people weren't as tightly scheduled as political figures are today, said sure. So Lincoln goes up to Janesville, he gives a talk, he spends the night at the Tallman house, and then he heads off to Rockford, Illinois, never to return to Wisconsin again. There's no evidence he didn't have a good time at the Tallman house, but anyway, so that if you go to the Rock County Historical Society in Janesville, and that the main facility there is the Tallman house, which was donated to the city as a museum by the family, you can see the bed that Lincoln slept in, and you can walk to the, I've done it, it's, there's the bed. And when you see the bed itself, and this goes back to why we go to museums to look at objects, and the Smithsonian Institution in Washington has a million such objects that have been used by famous people for one thing or another. I think that when you're in the presence of the bed, you're kind of in the presence of Lincoln himself. I don't know if I'd call it an aura, but there's the bed that the man actually slept in. Which is one reason you want to go to a museum to see stuff like that. But that kind of effect doesn't work on a website, because all on a website you're seeing is a picture of a bed. And so we decided that those kinds of objects, which are of interest mainly because they're associated with famous people, don't really fit into our website.
Okay.
Unless the object itself has reasons to be of interest for other purposes.
There is the movement for museums to return artifacts taken from other countries, from Native Americans. Talk a little bit about who owns the objects on Wisconsin 101.
Well, that's a complicated question. For us, again, it's not so much an issue, because all we're really working with are photos of the objects, and those are much less contentious than the actual possession of the objects. However, a version of the question comes up for us in who gets to tell the stories about the objects. And one of the things that we would like to have in an ideal world would be several stories about the same object, where you could get different viewpoints about the object from different communities. Mm-hmm. We haven't done that yet because, of course, I have to say our project, the staff, quote unquote, of our project consists of Sarah Thal, my co-director, who's a professor of history, myself, and then two graduate students who work for us. So we don't write these stories. We have to recruit people to write these stories, sometimes undergraduates, sometimes other historians from around the state, or undergraduate students from around the state. So the photos for us are not an issue, but it's definitely contentious to ask questions about who owns objects. And a really good example of that, if I might direct your listeners in this direction, is another inspiration for our project was the British Museum's project, A History of the World in 100 Objects, which was sort of publicized in 2010. There's a podcast series that BBC4, one of the domestic radio services, put together.
Yes.
And those were written by Neil McGregor, who was the director of the project and director of the British Museum. The podcasts are really interesting. And the first one is especially interesting because it's about a sarcophagus from Egypt. And in that, the director of the British Museum has to address the question of why the British Museum has all this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's a really interesting discussion. So it's a big problem that a lot of institutions around the world are dealing with.
Grappling with, yes. Well, turning to the objects on the website again, is this photo of the La Crosse Normal School fireplace. Why is this fireplace significant?
Well, it's amusing that this was chosen today to talk about a fireplace on you know, the coldest day of the year. The fireplace and the north, it represents a kind of small version, a miniature part of a school that was created in La Crosse, which is a model for a number of other UW campuses that were built in the early 20th century, right? So UW La Crosse began as a normal school. UW Eau Claire began as a normal school. I think Whitewater began as a normal school. I can't remember all of them. And in this case, the fireplace was sort of the centerpiece of a large recreational kindergarten room, as the photo on the website shows. And what the story talks about is the origins of UW La Crosse as a normal school, kind of, how the fireplace was designed. And then it talks about the evolution of the school into a teacher's college, and eventually into one of the Wisconsin State Universities, and eventually then part of the UW system, or as it's now called, the Universities of Wisconsin, a name that I kind of hate. So the story is really uses the fireplace as the focal point for talking about the building that lived these different lives, first as a normal school, then as a teacher's college, and so on.
It's kind of our through vehicle, yeah, if you will, to a much larger story about Wisconsin.
Yeah, it is. And, Wisconsin was not, I can't remember, Wisconsin was either one of the first states or the first state to come up with normal schools as a way of kind of creating more teachers for rural areas. So there's a good story here. And this isn't the only story about a normal school that became a university. There's another set of stories about the Council Oak Tree at UW Eau Claire, which is part of the university seal. A bench was made out of that tree when it was felled by lightning. And it's another story about how this school evolved from a normal school into a full four-year university.
Tom Broman with us, co-director of Wisconsin 101, as we talk about a public history project that aims to share Wisconsin's history through material objects. And you can join in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Tom, the site provides teaching tips for using Wisconsin 101 in the classroom. How do you hope teachers use the history of these objects in their curriculum?
There's a number of ways we could do it. It sort of depends on the age group you're talking about. So one thing I'll point out is that before the State Historical Museum closed, for the construction of the new and much larger museum that's going to come, we had objects from the mini tour from that museum that were basically used to demonstrate history. There was a felt beaver hat, and there was a grinding stone used for grinding corn, and so on. And the people who led those tours would take fourth graders around and use these objects, again, as a way of kind of giving kids a sense of the stuff of history. So we had those pictures on the website, and teachers could use that to sort of help the students recall, and it was a very popular part. What we would like teachers to do now is to have kids bring in objects and write at the level that they're able to, whether fourth graders or middle school students or high school students, to sort of use those objects to teach the history. And we've put up a few lesson plans. Susanna Schuller, the graduate student who's working for us, has written some wonderful lesson plans in collaboration with some teachers that we think could be used to first introduce high school students to the idea of using objects in history, and then sort of as you develop the idea to create small exhibits of local history of their own that would be used to bring objects together and describe them.
You can really feel the humanities come together through the writing and the telling and the history of it all. I really like that approach. Tom Broman with us, co-director of Wisconsin 101, our guide to this statewide collaborative public history project that uses objects as the centerpieces of local histories. And there's space to talk about objects that live and breathe Wisconsin that you know of. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts along the way. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. More to come. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about treasured and quirky historical objects with strong ties to Wisconsin. The public history project called Wisconsin 101 tells the stories of these everyday objects to uncover richer meanings into what Wisconsin is about. Be part of the conversation. Call in with a question. Share your objects. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have UW-Madison historian and co-director of Wisconsin 101, Tom Broman. Let's take a call. Nancy in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Hello. I'm calling because I want people to understand the value of the woman in the pioneer movement west. And, of course, Wisconsin was part of that at one time. I'm calling about the fact that I have two very heavy treadle sewing machines, and I'm telling you they're heavy because the upper part is solid oak, the bottom is wrought iron, and the machine itself is very heavy solid steel. Now, as the movements west became often occurring, many fields of actually not fields, but forests had to be cut down to establish fields which could grow the grain if homesteads were going to be established. And the valuable part of owning these sewing machines was that clothing had to be mended and new clothing made, because the establishment of a homestead made the clothing simply wore out, because the labors of establishing the homestead simply were under such duress.
Nancy, may I ask, are these antique sewing machines in working condition?
One of them is. I can use it, but I'm very inept at it because, of course, your feet have to move at a steady rhythm. But I feel it's important that people know the value of the woman. This was woman's work. She had to knit the gloves and the scarves and the hats for her family. She had to constantly mend clothing, which was being ripped and torn and burnt in the establishment of the homestead. And I feel it's just important that this object, which would have weighed, I can't even imagine how much, but it would have been a very heavy object to put on a Conestoga-type wagon to be dragged by mules.
Carry across, yes. Nancy, thank you so much. Tom, what comes up for you?
I think an object like that would be fascinating to be featured on the website. And there's this brings up the question of sort of a division between two parts of the website, because most of our object histories usually are aimed at situating the object in a particular place, right? So those sewing machines would feature on one part of our website if they could be set to a story about a particular family that lived in one part of the state, sort of give us a sense of locality. However, there's another part of the website called Your Story and Objects, which is kind of more informal. And there one can simply describe, just simply give us a picture of the object and send us a story about what you know about it. Maybe its role in your family's history or in your own life, something like that. But the caller is right. It would be fantastic to have stories about the tools and items used by families when they were first establishing themselves in the state. Those kinds of stories are wonderful for us.
Nancy, thanks for calling in. Tom, one of the reasons you started this project, Wisconsin 101, because you see a decline in history majors. What separates a public history project from other historical projects?
One of the things I think we want to do is to try and Sarah and I have been sort of very conscious about this from the beginning. One of the things we want to do is give the public a sense of why history counts as something we ought to be pursuing. You hear a lot of criticism about higher ed. Why aren't all the kids doing, you know, computer science and technical majors? Why are we still doing humanities? And I think that the way to push back against that kind of talk is to say, look, when we do history, we build our sense of our own identity, both in terms of the things that we share and the things that separate us. And we should be aware of those stories, and we should be communicating those stories, because it leads us to greater understanding. That's what public history should do, is give us a sense of ourselves in the place we live. That's why choosing Wisconsin as the boundary of the project makes sense, because we all are part of Wisconsin.
What do you tell someone who says, you know what, Tom, I can't think of an object that is significant enough or that evokes a sense of history that can really tell a story? What if they just don't see something, that material thing? What do you tell them?
There are two answers to that. One is, it takes a little practice to see, even in common objects, things that can be talked about. And again, this goes back to the part of the project called Your Story and Objects. One of the objects on that little site, and we haven't done much with it. We need to get, one reason I'd love to get more people who are listening today to send in objects. I posted on that website a little maple sap spout. It's a spout that's a cast aluminum spout that is used for tapping maple trees. And I used it when we owned some property up in southern Juneau County, northwest of Reedsburg in the central part of the state. And it was my first experience tapping maple sugar, maple sap, and then boiling it down for syrup. It was a wonderful experience. I did it for several years before we sold that property. An object like that is about my life in Wisconsin, for sure. It has very important personal meaning for me. And if you think about the objects around you and the stories you could tell about those objects, those are just as meaningful as the Lincoln bed, or as meaningful as a Harley Davidson's first two-stroke motorcycle engine, which we also have on the website, right? So they don't have to be objects that led to big things. They can be objects that are meaningful for you if you want to tell the stories about them.
What about people who might have a story to tell in their own lives? It's not a material possession per se.
There are lots of opportunities that local historical societies offer for recording personal histories, for getting involved in writing local histories. We are a little bit limited by the deliberate design we've put on the site to make it about objects. And objects is a pretty broad term, right?
Yeah.
The remnants of the dam that was going to be constructed in the Kickapoo Valley is on our website as well. So we have a flexible idea of object, but there's plenty of opportunities to get involved in local history through your local or county historical society. And I would urge people to do it, because there are lots of ways of doing public history that don't require objects, but nevertheless give you a chance to be part of this kind of community building project.
Tom Broman with us, co-director of the public history project called Wisconsin 101, as we take a look at the history of Wisconsin through objects. You can join in with questions and comments. Objects in your life, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tom, one of the objects listed on the site is James D. Williams' windlass. Why is the windlass important to include, and what is a windlass?
Yeah, this is one that a windlass is essentially a device that has a drum standing on two supports. And you attach a rope to the drum, and by turning the drum with a crank, you can raise or lower something from a well, for example. So if you lower a bucket into a well to get water, you crank up the bucket containing water using a windlass. So you have a drum to which a rope is attached. In this case, the windlass belonged to James D. Williams, who was a black man who came into the state while he was enslaved by someone, but he obtained his freedom. And then he set himself up near Ruie, Wisconsin, which is in western Iowa County. I live in Iowa County, so pretty close to where I live. And Williams got himself bought some mining rights, and then he began lead mining using this windlass in western Iowa County and in the driftless part of the state, in the southwest state. Lead mining and then later zinc mining were big business all over the southwest, Mineral Point, Platteville, and so on. This particular story was written by two students of a collaborator of ours, Gene Tesdall, who was a historian at UW-Platteville. So two of his undergrads wrote this story up first for the mining and Rollo Jamieson Museums in Platteville, and then we imported the story onto the website.
Does the windlass then exist at a museum? Where is it now?
Yeah, it's in the mining museum. It's in the museum in Platteville. You can go see it.
It should be.
Exactly. No, that's and actually it's a good idea of the relationship that we can use in publicizing collections of stuff that are in museums, right? So it gives people reason to go to Platteville and go to the museum. It's a good museum. There's lots of interesting stuff in it.
It can kind of whet your appetite for what is out there around Wisconsin and some of these objects that are in collections that you can visit.
Very much so. Very much so.
Tom Broman is co-director of Wisconsin 101 and emeritus professor of history of science at UW-Madison. The project is a statewide collaborative public history project that tells local histories through objects. You can call in with a question. You can add your insights, your own objects. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, our guide to Wisconsin objects that help tell the stories of our state. Tom Broman is here, co-director of Wisconsin 101 and professor emeritus of history of science at UW-Madison. Let's bring in Randy now in Ripon. Randy, hi.
Good morning. This brought to mind a friend of mine. He used to find objects, whether it's on a farm or a junkyard or an old household, And same thing with me. We would find them, and it could just be a part of something or a hole of something. And we would put it on the dining room table, and then we would all kind of take turns kind of trying to figure out what it was, what its function was. It just made a lot of conversation. It was kind of fun to do. And then eventually we would look it up and see what it actually was. But it was just a fun thing to do for us.
Randy, what was one thing that you did find that you figured out what it was?
Oh, God, I don't know. It's been so long since we've done this. I think it was something to do with some type of farm. I think it might have been like what it comes to mind is one of those tracks for hay bales in the old barn loft, the hay loft.
Mm-hmm.
Mechanism for lifting him up and lowering him or whatever it was. I think that might have been it. These old houses and barns and stuff, I mean, there's just all kinds of neat stuff. So
sure is. Yeah, Randy, thank you. Tom, I think you could start a game about, you know, guess the history of the thing on the table.
I agree completely. Flea markets are great for that, right? Or farm auctions, right? There are sometimes you go to farm auctions and you find all kinds of stuff, and it's the same thing. What was that used for? And flea markets, you see the same thing. A lot of, especially now, a lot of kids growing up today are not, given the kinds of products we buy, people are not used to taking things apart and fixing them using tools. So a lot of tools that probably someone of my generation will be familiar with are going to become less familiar to kids growing up today. So that game could be played by a lot of people. And again, if you have objects that you think are kind of interesting to you personally, and you have just some kind of Wisconsin connection with them, please send them into your story and objects, because we'd love to post photos of them. It'd be great to have more objects like that.
Let's bring in Sherry now in La Crosse. Sherry, what is your object?
Well, it's kind of inherited a ledger book from a country school in Vernon County. My gra- grandmother taught there, but it was actually belonged to her father when he was on, I guess would be the school board equivalent, from the late 1800s, early 19, I don't even know if it got into the 1900s, but I got a chance to read it. It was interesting because, you know, she spent $1.50 on a broom that year and stuff like that. And I did end up donating it to the Historical Society for Vernon County. I kind of wish I had copied some of the papers off, though, because it was kind of interesting read. But it was very delicate, too, so I wanted to make sure it was preserved.
Well, Sherry, thank you for bringing that. A ledger from a Vernon County Country School. Tom, what could that help tell in history?
Coda depends on how it was used, right? It could be used to talk about the kinds of lessons that were offered to students. It could be used to offer testimony about the kinds of expenses the school incurred. The ledgers could be used. I mean, I'm not enough of an expert in how education happened at that level. But again, a ledger would be something fascinating to have for your story and objects. Because depending on what was in it, you could do all kinds of great things about what education looked like. It goes back to the La Crosse Normal School, right? That at that time in the early 20th century, education was far less structured in the ways we think about it is today. It'd be a great object to have.
Sherry, thank you. Lynn now in Eau Claire. Lynn, hi.
Good morning. I am originally not from Wisconsin, but I do value history. History is an amazing subject. I have family history. I have a Singer sewing machine that was my grandmother's, who would have been 122 this year. It was a treadle. Then it was electric. That's what I learned on. I can hand sew quicker, but it's how my family grew with technology. Now I've got a couple of, you know, fancy programmable sewing machines. I also have a beaded flapper bag that one of my mother's great aunts used. And I decided early on, because we do learn from history, my family, as of when my grandmother's generation, they grew up on a farm in Iowa, 6 children, all college educated. But I decided it would be a good thing to learn everything my great grandmother knew, just to touch the past.
To touch the past. Yeah. Oh, Lynn, thank you so much. One thing there that to me sounded really intriguing was the beaded flapper bag. Perhaps I would imagine, Tom, from the 1920s evening bags.
I would think so, yeah. Actually, Lynn, please, if you're at all inclined, please send us a picture of that sewing machine for your story and objects, and just write a paragraph about how your grandmother used it. It'd be great to have it. I want to make another comment about sewing. Like Lynn, I have to admit, I didn't grow up in Wisconsin. I grew up in Northern Illinois. When I was in high school in the 1970s, a lot of the girls in our high school sewed their own clothes. They got Simplicity patterns and they went to the fabric store and got some fabric and made their own clothes. And that was a kind of, I don't mean to say everyone did, but it was not uncommon to do that. And so between then and now, you've really seen the sort of passing of a knowledge about how to do sewing, I think, that Lynn alludes to.
Well, from sewing to soda cans here, the project has collaborated with WPR's Wisconsin Life. And one story from this collaboration explored the history of Jolly Good soda. And this here is Wisconsin Life contributor Rachel Vasquez.
If you're having trouble remembering Jolly Good, maybe this will ring a bell.
The next time you're in a food store buying cola, root beer, orange, or any flavored soda, take a good look at the price. I mean a really good look. At Jolly Good, we believe in quality, but we also believe in value. We want you to get your money's worth.
Jolly Good was beloved by Midwesterners in its heyday. Career Foods started the brand in the 1970s in Belgium, Wisconsin. But after decades of filling fridges across the region, competition from the big soda companies edged them out. They sold the last case of Jolly Good in 2007. But then 2013 rolled around, and an uncle and his nephew had an idea.
Okay, Tom, so why is this story a good candidate for Wisconsin 101?
Oh, it's a great story because our best stories are about objects. First of all, the Jolly Good represents a whole lot of experiences that people of my generation had. And it's about a locality. It was, the company was originally in Belgium, but the place where Jolly Good was made is in Random Lake. And for those who don't know the entire geography of the state, we're talking about Sheboygan County, basically to the north, northwest of Sheboygan, right? So it, between, in the east central part of the state. And Jolly Good, well, Jolly Good was in stores in northern Illinois when I was a kid. And it's just so much, it's rich with what that meant to the economy of that area. We have a lot of manufactured objects like Jolly Good on it. And I want to say, too, while we're here, I'm so glad you included this because our cooperation and collaboration with Wisconsin Life goes back to when Erica Janik first started Wisconsin Life a number of years back. And it's continued with Maureen McCullum, and we value it so much. There's so much good work that can be done. And so we're deeply appreciative of that.
Well, this has been such a fun tour through objects and through history. Tom, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's been great. I so much appreciate it, Kate.
Tom Broman is co-director of the Statewide Public History Project. It is called Wisconsin 101. Tom is Emeritus Professor of History of Science at UW-Madison. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.